Blog Talk Radio.
Lay your hands on the radio. Lay your hands on the radio band at home.
It's that psychedelic time of the year. Do you know where your brain cells are?
Blog Talk Radio.
You know, there's an enormous industry in this nation that is churning out day after day at the cost of billions of dollars the sensation, entirely erroneous, in the body politic that everything is okay and everything's going to keep on being just the way it is now on into the indefinite future. But of course,
Radio Free Canada
have not purchased that bill of goods.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth.
You can handle the truth!
Welcome to Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Dell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas.
When I was a little kid, I was kind of small, a bit bigger than a grasshopper, maybe 2 feet tall. So when I had to use a john, I'd get up with a hop, plant my feet upon the toilet seat, and I'd squat on top. This usually worked just fine, but one day I ate some spicy curry, and to get upon that toilet, I was in a hurry. I jumped onto the toilet, coming along just swell, but then, oops, I lost my balance, and suddenly I fell. Don't fall into the toilet, not where you want to be. Don't fall into the toilet when it's filled with pee. Don't fall into the toilet, whatever else you do. Don't fall into the toilet when it's filled with poo. In water, oh yes, for goodness sake, the ocean or a river, a hot tub or a lake. But if you wanna take a swim, I'd try hard to avoid swimming in the water where your poop has been deployed. Don't fall into the toilet, not where you wanna be. Don't fall into the toilet when it's filled with pee. Don't fall into the toilet, whatever else you do. When it's filled with poo. But if you like to splash around, then you and I agree, you can splash inside the bathtub or on the deep blue sea. But listen to me, people, one important rule: don't go splashing in the same place you deposited your stool. Don't fall into the toilet, not where you want to be. Don't fall into the toilet when it's filled with pee. Don't fall into the toilet, whatever else you do. Don't fall into the toilet when it's filled with poo.
That was Dave Rowitz. Don't fall in the toilet. Did you know David has a bunch of free music for you to download and certainly buy a CD from him at davidrowitz.com? Oh, man. He has a whole series of kiddie songs like that. Although here in Kansas, I think that might be a warning. Don't fall in the toilet, especially when there's poo. Here in Kansas, the voters have fell in the toilet, and now we're climbing out. They voted for U.S. Senator Sam Brownback, and a whole slew of Republicans are coming in, and it's just a mess. I'm telling you, it's just a mess. I tell you, it's going to be something else. The next 4 years of Senator Brownback being on there, you never know.
That's your answer. That's your answer to everything. Answer it on your forehead. Your revolution is over, Mr. Lebowski. Condolences, the bomb's lost, My advice to you is to do what your parents did. Get a job, sir. The bones will always lose. You hear me, Lebowski? The bones will always lose.
How was your meeting, Mr. Lebowski?
Okay. The old man told me to take any rug in the house.
Yes, that's right. The old man said we could take any rug in the house. Well, you never know here in Kansas, I'll tell you. Yes, hearts go out to Ryan Newell. Ryan Newell is a paraplegic veteran, lost both of his legs in the Afghanistan War. He's now being held down the Sedgwick County Jail in Wichita, Kansas, for $500,000 bond. Sort of feel sorry for the guy, you know? What did he do? Are you asking, what did he do? Well, here in the crazy mixed-up world of Kansas, Ryan Newell decided he was going to follow the Westboro Baptist churches, the Fred Phelps gang, as they were parading about Mulvane, Kansas recently, so he followed them around. Well, who knows what he wanted to do, right? Frustrated, depressed, lost his leg in a war, a stupid war. Here he comes. He's a Kansan, Ryan Newell. Got a car full of guns, ammunition. Police stop him, of course. We spent a lot of time in Kansas protecting Fred Phelps' First Amendment rights, that's for sure. And he's now on a half million. I just hear today on the news that the prosecutors are going to add another felony charge. Now, he was just charged with a bunch of misdemeanors when they threw him in on a $500,000 bail. But now they're going to add a felony to it. Boy, I'm telling you, it's just no help here for the wounded, the walking wounded, get no help from these cruel, cruel, compassionate conservatives. That is for sure. Here we go. It's so sorry.
Run away, Brandon.
Is this your only ID?
You know my rights, man.
You don't know shit, Lebowski.
I want a fucking lawyer, man. I want the old counselor, man. Or wrong could be.
Mr. Treehorn tells us that he had to eject you from his garden party. That you were drunk and abusive.
Mr. Treehorn treats objects like women, man.
Mr. Treehorn draws a lot of water in this town. You don't draw shit, Lebowski. Now, we got a nice, quiet little beach community here, and I aim to keep it nice and quiet. So let me make something play. I don't like you sucking around bothering our citizens, Lebowski. I don't like your jerk-off name. I don't like your jerk-off face. I don't like your jerk-off behavior. And I don't like you, jerk-off. Do I make myself clear? I'm sorry, I wasn't listening.
Ow! Fucking fascist! Ow! Get out of Malibu, Lebowski! Ow! Get out of Malibu, dead feet!
Keep your ugly fucking gold brick and ass out of my beach community.
Thank you.
It's Alamo time. Alamo time. Alamo. Man the walls, you pathetic progressives. Yes, Alamo time in Kansas, that's for sure. Alamo time. Last stand on the little bighorn for progressives. Progressives in Kansas. They're coming to get you. They're coming to get you, you progressives. That's right. You poor, pathetic progressives got outran by the libertarians and the tea parties and all that stuff, man. Oh, my God, it's pathetic. Oh, I think we got our man from Washington. And I think we have Yasha Levine. Folks, did I tell you Yasha Levine is going to be on Radio Free Kansas? We're going to talk about who bitch slapped the Koch brothers, the billionaires down there in Wichita. And I got some stuff to add to it now. Yes, that's right. And our man doing the Washington Report is going to be on. He's coming on right now. They're both on, I think. I don't know. Let's check in. I'm going to check in one. Let's see if Yasha is on. Yasha, welcome to Radio Free Kansas. Can you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear. How you doing?
Okay. Hey, Yasha, do you mind if we give 5 minutes to our man in Washington talking about what happened
Please.
In the Congress here? All right, hold on. So we'll be right back with you. Hang on there. I think our man in Washington, Mark Cansale, he's going to talk to us about. Are you on air? Welcome to Radio Free Kansas, Mark.
Thank you.
Yep. Hey, brother, what? Give us an Alamo time report here on progressive politics and that.
Well, the Republicans and the Tea Party members have surrounded the Capitol, and the Democrats are the Texans. So it looks very bleak for us for the liberal left for the next 2 years, maybe longer. As we all know, we're in a lame duck session, which if no one knows what that means that all these useless bills are going to be pushed through, and the majority of the House, which is right now Democrats, are trying to push all these bills through. But, of course, they got the Republican Party sitting on the thumbs saying, we're not doing anything until we can negotiate the big extension on the tax cuts. Well, the big thing is that they want the extension on the tax cuts to continue on indefinitely. Yes, folks, you heard me correctly. Indefinitely. But not for everybody. They want to just do it for the upper, anybody of $250,000 and more, indefinitely. The Bush tax cuts. Now, if we all go back to 2007, when these tax cuts were brought in to play, it led us into the worst recession we ever had in recorded history in our country. So I say, make the son of a bitches pay. Through the nose.
Right.
You know, because...
That's the shit out of them rich bastards.
Yep. And because people don't understand that the people who are carrying this country are the lower middle and lower income bracket people. The guys that go out and the women and men that go out and do the minimum wage jobs and out in the ditches, digging the ditches, the trenches, whatever you want to call it. But they're out there. That's who supports us and pays the taxes. 8 years ago, the average income tax, I just got read this on Wikipedia, that 10 years ago, an individual that was making $1.5 million paid less taxes than a man that made $35,000, because he had all the millionaire had the tax cuts,
mm-hmm.
and the lower income guy, $35,000 lower mundane income 10 years ago, didn't have any of those. Had one tax break, well, two if he had kids, and his mortgage payment. Because if he's a working stiff, he didn't have any business expenses or anything like that. So he had two deductions, and he ended up paying more. in income tax than the guy who made $1.5 million. And that's what.
But, you know, I want to interject something. Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont, was on the well of the Senate. Yakking this week, this I think Monday or Tuesday, and there's a YouTube of it, by the way.
Yep.
And he pointed out, he said that, this is a quote, well, pretty damn near to a quote, ExxonMobil made $19 billion, this is in just 2009 alone, $19 billion in profits, and they didn't pay one dime of taxes. And as a matter of fact, they received $156 million in refunds on do you believe that shit?
Yep,
I can believe it.
I can believe it. Well, here's what's really got me. Now, as of December 1st, the Democrats were pushing before December 1st, in the lame duck session, the Democrats were pushing the extension of unemployment benefits for the unemployed people in the country. And as November, December 1st, those, that's how they had to do it, because they didn't do it by November, December 1st, the extension didn't pass the bill. Well, that's when over, I think it was six million people receiving unemployment are going to run out. So the Republicans are basically saying, well, Merry Christmas, you know. And that's, they're talking all sorts of crazy stuff, you know, privatizing.
Now, wait a minute. I thought it was 2 million were going to lose their checks this week if they didn't. And then,
6 million
and then
total.
I heard the House of Representatives pass the unemployment extension. And where is it at? We got to be quick because online.
The news I got, it did not pass. It did not.
Uh-oh.
They did not act on it, so the unemployment compensation ran out. Now, if it passed, well, that means these people, according to the bill, if it did pass, they have to reapply and wait. It's just like starting all over again. So it's, you know, it's just a bad scenario for everybody. And but what's really what if you have to look, you know, look behind the scenes. They use that unemployment benefit package to be passed. The Republicans did. As a way to get Bush's tax cuts extended indefinitely. So this is where they're at. You know, met behind doors. The Republican majority leaders met behind closed doors with President Obama, and the big issue is taxes. That's, you know, these tax cuts. That's what's holding everything up, and it looks like the Democratic Party is going to fold in and give in to these tax cuts. But the Democrats want to give tax cuts to everybody, extend them to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a rough year in 2011.
Wait a minute. You're saying that the Democrats are saying they want to extend the tax cuts for everybody.
If they're going to...
What about the rich? I mean, where are these wealthy bastards that Senator Bernie Sanders said there's like a, you know, a... half of 1% are not paying, are not even paying shit because 60% of corporations don't even pay taxes. I mean, what the hell?
What are the Democrats doing?
Hey, and I got a question. I got a final question from hell. I want you to stay online because I'd like you to hear Yasha Levin from the outrageously wonderful Exiled Online. I want you to stay on, but I got a question from hell in Kansas for you, Mark Cansell. Uh-huh. Can you give me your comment, then I got my trigger question to ask you. Go ahead. Got any more? Nope.
Yes. Well,
okay.
See what's going on. Flashback 2 years ago, 18 months ago when President Obama was running for President of the United States. And his main platform about taxes is that anybody above $250,000 a year were not going to be extended the Bush tax cuts. They would be ended. Well, now that he's flip-flopping, because now the Senate is manned by the Republicans, and they want to extend those tax breaks. So the Democrats are saying, well, you know, it's going to disrupt the economy, because the Republicans think if we extend the tax breaks to the rich, who In their morbid way of thinking, they think the rich people provide jobs for everybody. That it will create more jobs, which will stimulate the economy. That's what the Republicans are going on. The Democrats are saying, well, yeah, but if the poor people don't have money to spend, how are they going, you know, we need to reinject money back into the economy, and the quickest way of doing that is for collect unemployment. Well, the Republicans are saying, you know, this is a Republican Senate leader stated, well, they're just holding back their unemployment checks. They're not spending them.
Oh, yeah. Right. We're all sitting around. We're putting them in a bank account, saving our whole account.
I saw that on the Rachel Maddow show on MSNBC, and he said that on national TV, he said that, well, what's going on is the people collecting unemployment checks are holding them back. They're not spending. And she says, well, you know, they're saying they lived unemployment check to buy food, to pay rent, pay utilities. You know, of course they're injecting the money immediately back into the economy. And the Republican leaders really feel that the reason the economy isn't growing as fast as they want it to grow is that the people receiving unemployment compensation checks are hoarding them. So that's why this is the basics of the reasons they want to extend the tax cuts to the rich, because their hypothesis is that, well, if we extend these tax cuts to the rich, who are capitalists, they provide more jobs than anybody, they'll hire more people.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
that's
about
again.
$5 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And we starve you enough, now we'll give you $7 an hour. How's that?
Yeah, it's that's what this whole thing is going on about, this unemployment thing. So they're using the unemployment package, is saying we'll pass it if you pass the indefinite tax cuts to indefinite means forever tax cuts to the wealthy, anybody over $250,000 a year. So
that's,
the Democrats,
that's called extortion.
Yeah,
that's blackmail.
Well, it's called politics. So the Democrats are pushing. The Democrats are pushing the corner. Let me finish. The Democrats are pushing the corner. So they're sitting, and they know they're going to be outvoted January 3rd. They're going to be outvoted. And the tax cuts will get passed, and they're going to be outvoted. So what they're saying is saying, okay, we'll vote for the tax cuts, but it's for everybody. That's where they're at right now. And that is what's going on the Hill in Washington, D.C.
They're mortgaging the working class, the poor bastards in this state, the
mortgaging
poor people
them.
In this state, in the country, they're mortgaging the whole country's poor, working poor, to pay off these rich bastards. Again, I don't – time for your question from hell, and I want you to hang on, but here's the question from hell. Are you ready for your question from hell in Kansas?
Go ahead.
What do you think Kansans care about who listen to Glenn Beck? Now, this is just a – I know it's just a shot in the dark for you, but here's the question. What do you think Glenn Beck listeners of Kansas conservative radio care more about, tax cuts for the wealthy or how many Christmas trees Obama has in the White House? And I can tell you how many he's got.
I think they're more concerned about the Christmas trees in the White House.
They're right. There's 19 Christmas trees in the White House, and these people have spent hours and hours on the telephone on hate talk radio talking shit on Obama over the 19 Christmas trees while the very legislation you have described is going to the House of Representatives. And we're going to go right on to Yasha Levine here. I'll think I get, see if I get the line open, and I'll get him on. I want Yasha to – Yasha, are you listening, brother?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, I want you to tell – now, I got a feeling my Radio Free Kansas is going to be ran off the air in a similar fashion like what was the name of the newspaper in Russia?
It was called The Exile, so –
tell us
now
about
we're
that.
The exiles.
I think they're coming after me, brother. Tell us how they did it. I want people to get a little background, deep background on the exile. tell us a little bit about you, because it's a great war story.
So the newspaper was an English language newspaper that opened up in Moscow, Russia, in 1997. And it was shut down in 2008, in the summer of 2008. And very unexpectedly, you know, there's just came in with an audit that they suspected us of publishing extremist messages, and it was very vague. And so they took a bunch of issues from our office, and they took them back to analyze them, which is pretty funny, because we're kind of a satire, but serious political journalism mixed with satire.
Right.
And so we make fun of, for instance, like Medvedev. President Medvedev was just elected, and we compare him to his weight to like Kate Moss and things like that. So, because he's a little short guy, and so we were just comparing him to various things, like how big is he, how much does he weigh, and and so they must have had a kind of a, well, I don't know, the paper was never. The way that it was shut down, it wasn't like they came in and they barricaded the door and took all our computers or anything. No, what they did was, it was simple. They came in and the audit, this kind of random audit they called it, was enough to send our couple of investors that we had that were putting in a little bit of money into the newspaper and kind of helping it stay afloat. They were scared, so they were scared away, because essentially we were called the enemy of the state, right? But with that, so the company dissolved because they had no more money anymore, because they just pulled all their money out of the paper. So, and the funny thing is that the paper was actually, we were probably the most pro-Russian newspaper, English language newspaper in existence. It wasn't so much that we were pro-Russian as that we were more truthful about Russia. See, there's a lot of distortions about Russia in the Western media, calling Putin, a gangster and, Stalin and all sorts of things where, he's not the greatest guy in the world, but, you got to put things into perspective. And the real reason, people don't like Putin in the West is because he cares more about Russia's national interest than about America's national interest. So he won't, sell out his oil interest, his country's oil interest to ExxonMobil or to BP or to anyone else. And so that is the problem with him, right? And so that was what the exile was known for, is calling out the bullshit of Western press about demonizing Russia and because it wouldn't. It wouldn't, submit and roll over for
corporate interest. I believe that. I believe that. I've been watching Russia Today. By the way, folks, RT.com, it's worth it. But I really enjoy, they had even PBS, God damn them, liberal hides, they actually did something great. They had a special on the influence of the Beatles in Russia, which I didn't know anything about, and it was just amazing. Yeah. It was an amazing thing to see these several generations, the influence of opening up culture in Russia. And all in all, I'm beginning to sort of dig Russia. I sort of dug them before. My son wants to take a language course and learn Russia. But, so you're saying that this was sort of a vague. What were they? What did they want? Your subscribers?
Well, it's very difficult. Look, it was actually very funny because, the newspaper survived or lived through, and was not really harassed through the Yeltsin presidency, through the entire Putin presidency. So Putin was this horrible anti, he was a Stalin. Essentially, like a modern Stalin, who was running a totalitarian state, and if he allowed the exile to exist and unharassed for the most part. And then Medvedev was elected, right? And he's sort of considered to be more liberal and more Western and more pro-democratic, right? And as soon as he's elected, we get shut down. So it's kind of almost like it's almost like this Obama thing where the worst comes under the liberals, right? So-called liberals. And so it's not clear. You know, we had a columnist. His name is Edward Limonov. He is a long time. He was a Soviet dissident. And he was kind of kicked out of the Soviet Union. He lived in France. He lived in America for a while, and then he came back to Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. He started a political party called the National Bolshevik Party, and they're kind of like these. People, they're called little Nazi youth or something like that, but they're not really, they're just kind of like a punk, like an punk opposition party for young, a younger opposition movement, right, that incorporated a lot of punk elements into it, and being a bit ironic when they call themselves the National Bolshevik, right? Kind of the National Socialist Party.
That is weird.
So, and they are for a return to a kind of more of a communist, more of a socialist state where everything is, all the resources are owned by the people, right? The oil or resources are not allowed to be exploited by corporations, things like that. So they actually just want a redistribution of wealth in the country, which is, Russia has. is a neoliberal state. It's kind of a dream state, right? Where everything was privatized in a matter of years, and all of the assets in the country. And there are a lot of it's a very resource rich country. It has oil, it has gas, it has timber, it has all sorts of resources. And they just went to just really a handful of people. You can count them on two hands. That own all the wealth, and so that's really what the party. And so he's a world famous kind of guy. He published a number of great books. He's a celebrity of sorts, and so we published him, and he's like a persona non grata. He served in jail in Moscow because he was accused of trying to organize an overthrow of Kazakhstan, an armed overthrow of Kazakhstan, which he was accused of that, which is, was bullshit. And he was he spent a couple of years in jail in Moscow. And he's really, he's always watched by the KGB. They're always stationed outside his house. He always has to travel with bodyguards. And so we published him regularly. And so, that could have been what triggered it. It's really not, you don't know how the Kremlin is a kind of is a mysterious force sometimes. You're not really sure why things happen, for what reason, and why now, But the fact is,
Well, your buddy's Mark Ames, he was over there with you when all this happened, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah.
It was the two of us running the newspaper, yeah.
Let's settle an internet rumor while we're doing this background on the Exiled. And by the way, listeners, man, Exiled Online is just—it's the cat's meow. I love that place. I love reading your stuff. But here's an internet rumor that was going around, and that Max KB, either worked for you guys or he's just copycatting your style. Because we have a theory out here among the gonzo journalists in Kansas, and there's not many of us, but we've studied gonzo journalism. He got nominated, I don't know, he's with Rolling Stone, by the way, which he's a great writer, and I like him. Some of my more mainstream journalists out here in Kansas can't stand him because of his use of profanities, but I think, hey, more people will read it if he call a spade, But you're right. And Rolling Stone magazine is just littered, listeners. If you haven't been there, you have littered, clustered pop downs, menus. It's just nonstop ads, which is not what you're going to get at Exiled Online. They're very good about that. But You know, did he have anything to do with Exiled on Life? Because he sure writes sort of like a man on fire.
Well, like, yeah, no. Yeah, he did. He, Mark Ames, when Mark Ames was starting the Exile in 97, I mean, this was before my time, this is before I came on board. But when Mark Ames was starting the Exile, I mean, he essentially recruited Matt from what I, and you know, they started the newspaper together. So they were founding editors of the Exile, yeah. And they Matt stayed on board for I'm trying to recall now when he left. 2001, maybe 2002 he left. I'm not certain of the year. So they so he definitely is connected to the Exile.
So the Exile was really actually running for quite a while before it got shut down, huh? That's amazing.
Yeah,
huh?
So 11 years, yeah.
Right, that's impressive, man. Well, you know, I'll tell you, that is, listeners, one of the best sites, if you want on local big boys who made it big, you know, the billionaire Koch brothers down there in Wichita, Kansas, and New York City, that's where David Koch is hanging out now most of his time. You've got to read the updated version and the old version of Yasha's article on the people's history of the Koch brothers, which is just one of the, you know, I first read Jane Mayer, by the way. I'm sure she's probably going to get a Pulitzer or will be nominated for a Pulitzer for her article in The New Yorker. But, you know, honestly, Yasha, I think, man, there's no hands down, you did a better job, dude.
Well, I mean, exactly. You know, I have no problem with journalists lifting my work, you know, and using it. But it's no problem. But you know, at least they could do is do it in a timely fashion, you know, because it took her a year and a half.
You wrote the first People's History of Koch a long time ago, dude, and then you updated it recently.
Well, no, but even the first one was published. You know, the first one was about how they were running the whole Tea Party show, right? So, you know, that's kind of the thrust of her. What her article is all about, right? That they are these political players, you know, funding the Obama hate machine or whatever she called it.
Right.
You know, and that's connected to the Tea Parties, right? So, you know, Mark Ames and I mean, this is right when we came back from Russia. You know, I was just a couple of months back, and we were watching this whole thing. And we were like, God damn, what is going on here? You know, this Tea Party, you know, building, and we because in Russia, you know, we had a little bit of experience with virtual politics, right? You know, because in Russia, there were these parties created, you know, political parties and political youth movements that were linked to the ruling party or to Putin, right? So Putin, in a sense, what he would do is, or in his political strategists would do is they would create kind of a party that was more of an extremist party, right? But they knew that you know Russia is you know has a lot of nationalistic kind of elements in it, and it's a very powerful force, like nationalism and racism in a lot of ways. So anyone who's not Russian, anyone who's not like Slavic or white, who maybe is you know Muslim or little Caucasian, you know, it's kind of like in America. There are a lot of people in America that don't like anyone who's not white, you know. But it's almost not as important, right? I mean, it is, but really, if you're white and not, you know,
No, you're not. You're not in Kansas, brother. You believe me, Yasha, brother.
Okay, right? That's true. If you're not white, if you're white, what are you? I mean, you have to be, you know, Christian. What else can you be, right? What kind of normal white person wouldn't be Christian? I mean, you gotta be you.
I don't know. My old man had me circumcised just in case I wanted to go the other way.
You're a communist, probably. That's why. Yeah, we know white people can't be communists. You know, it's impossible.
No, he wanted me to become a Jew if I wanted to be with painted. That's exactly what he did. He told me.
Well, here's this. Well, how about this? I'm a Jew and I'm not circumcised. Well, how about that? So I'm just, you know.
Well, the only reason I asked because there was a guy named Clifford Hammond in the football locker room at Leroy High School, and he was hung like a mule. He had a horse dick a mile long. And I went off to Dad, and I said, Dad, his dick's a lot different than mine. He said, well, boy, you circumcised. I said, well, what's that? He said, well, that's where they slit your foreskin, Mike, you dumbass. And he was sort of like a Red on the 70s show. And he said, they slit your foreskin, you dumbass. I said, well, why'd you have the doctor do that? He said, well, if you wanted to become a Jew later on, you would get in made free. I still looked at Clifford Hammond's mule dick every time I looked at football. I'm sorry, you understand it.
It's all right.
A little bit of shit.
Anyway, so going back to the virtual,
let's get back
virtual
to
politics.
Yeah.
You know, coming back from Russia, we understood how it works, and we saw it in action. So what would happen was, you know, Putin to make sure that he doesn't lose that he does not lose control over any party, right? That some kind of party doesn't spring up come out of nowhere and kind of challenge his power, right? They would create parties for each kind of different types of parties that would appeal to a broad spectrum of people, right? So you would have sort of the main party, which was United Russia. And that was, you know, like, I don't know, maybe like the Republican Party or something, right? Which was the main Putin-connected party that, you know, won all the elections, right? But then they would also have these little minor parties that would get a couple of percent here and there, right? They would look like they were independent, and they would take these, you know, and they would sometimes berate the ruling party. They would be in opposition to it. But in reality, they were not. They were actually kind of right, they were a part of the same machine. They were just—it's like a marketing thing. So you have a Ford Crown Victoria or something, right? And then you can have all sorts of different—I don't know—or like a town car, right? And you have different types of models for different people. So there's like the limousine edition, and there's like then there's the one that's more for taxis, and one for police, right? So you have a product that you can segment, right? Segment into for different uses, and so they would have the really really hate-filled party, the one that was against anyone who is dark, right? But that was connected to Putin, right? But they would control these parties, and so it's virtual democracy in a way, right? Because in a democracy, you have these parties that are supposed to be competing independently for power, and you vote for one, and the one who gets the most votes wins, right? And the one who has appeals to most of the people. Well, here you control all the parties, but only they're all controlled by the same people. So when we came back here, you know, we were looking at this Tea Party thing, and we sort of, you know, it triggered alarms of the same kind, and we jumped on it right away. So this was in February 2009, right before the Tea Party. The Tea Party has erupted. I think it was on February 23rd or something like that. The first National Tea Party happened February 23rd, 2009. And so right the day before, we published a piece connecting the whole Tea Party machine, all the websites that sprung up, all these activists, to FreedomWorks and Americans for Prosperity, which are both co-connected.
Big money.
Think tanks.
Big money behind those groups. Big money.
Oh, big money. You know, it's job creators. You know, that's what they are. You know, job creators. Oh, you know, all those Tea Party, unemployed Tea Party people. You know, they need their jobs, I guess.
And
you know,
then you stumbled into the mythical realm of the Koch brothers, and I don't want you to relate too successful. I know I got listeners from my email blast this morning when I teased them with you know, who bit slapped the billionaire brothers from Kansas, the Koch brothers. Someone bit slapped them, and I don't want you to tell them yet because I got a story I want to tell you about the Koch brothers. But I want you to tell you, you sort of stumbled on that there were some commonality among these groups. It wasn't just Dick Armey. Dick Armey wasn't just the only man behind.
Exactly.
I think isn't it Freedom Works or he's behind.
Yeah, Dick Armey. Uh-huh. Yeah, Dick Armey, Freedom Works.
But then you started putting out this wonderful article, rather lengthy history of the Koch brothers from Kansas, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Something happened there. Yeah. Well
they're from Texas, probably. Actually, you know, originally. Or were they Dutch, actually? Yeah.
I didn't know they were from Texas, but I know this. They own five counties in Texas. In terms, there's a thing called Matador Cattle Company.
Mm-hmm.
And they own, since you were on last time with Robert Perry, I started digging harder, you know, and I found out they own 440,000 acres of Matador Cattle Company.
Mm-hmm.
I guess was founded by Freddie. They call him Freddie down in Wichita, by the way. Did you know that? And
hey,
Freddie.
How you doing?
Yeah. He's dead now, isn't he? Freddie's
dead. God.
Fred's dad, he was a
and thank
who,
God
he was a father.
Yeah, hey, he was a father. He was a Charles. Yeah, there's. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Freddie and a little short thing about Freddie because there's a deep background there's a Russian connection to that too in there.
Exactly. So Freddie was born to a man named Harry. Koch, who came from Holland. He came from, he's Dutch. He came in 1882, I think. It's 1882 or 1888,
yeah.
In Texas to northern Texas. It's right near the Panhandle and border with Oklahoma. And he was a newspaper man and, somewhat of a booster from what I understand, like a local booster. And he had, his first son was, I think his only son, if I'm not mistaken correctly, was Freddie Koch,
mm-hmm.
Frederick Chase Koch is his full name. And he went to, and he was actually kind of a smart guy. He went to MIT, I believe. He went to MIT and graduated, and he was an engineer, and he graduated and started an oil company, which came up, he came up with a partner of his, he came up with a new oil refining method. So that was more efficient than what existed at the time. And he tried to market this thing right to oil companies as a way to refine oil, but the oil cartel of the time, they did not want him like budging in on their business. So essentially, they prevented him from marketing, from selling his invention in America. So this is the free market. This is the Roaring Twenties, and he's trying to. So he's this little, you know, he's this young man. Who invented, you know, a great new product, and he tried to sell it on the market, on the free market. You know, this is Roaring Twenties, so there are no rules, no regulation of any kind, right? So
this is yeehaw,
complete
yeehaw.
Free market. Yeah, exactly. Woo! And he was prevented by the local, by the oil cartel, right? The monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
They came and they said, "Hell no, you ain't selling. You're not getting in on our business, boy." And so where does a man go, you know? When capitalism fails you, where does a young man go? He goes to
Russia.
The Soviet Union.
What?
He goes over to the communists, obviously. So he
yeah.
becomes a communist. No. He doesn't become a communist. He goes into business with the communists.
Oh no, he didn't become a communist. No.
Of course not. No. And let's see what else happened. Somehow or other, you know, this is very, very interesting. I'm still trying to understand exactly how it happened. How does a guy get a contract with Stalin? You know, I don't know.
I think he probably got drunk with him.
He probably got drunk with him, man, like Arm and Hammer, you know?
Probably, exactly, yeah. Exactly, like Arm and Hammer. So anyway, so he went over there, and because the Soviet Union was industrializing at this point, like, so they were, you know, Stalin had his like first 5-year plan. I mean, he was taking this, you know, agrarian society into, you know, trying to turn it into an industrialized nation in just, you know, in a decade, right? And so they needed to refine their oil. So, you know, Russia has a lot of oil, and they needed refineries built. And so Koch was contracted to build, I think, 15 or 13 refineries in the Soviet Union in the 30s, right before the war. And he got paid fairly, very well for doing that. And he even trained Soviet technicians and engineers in Kansas, right? So they came over. They flew them over here, or I don't know, or boated them over here. I don't know how they probably boated them.
Really?
Over.
In Canada? I'll have to check on that. No kidding.
Yeah. They came over here.
I'll check on that.
Exactly. So he actually hosted commie oil engineers in Kansas. Yeah, to train them. So he was one of the people who essentially helped the Soviet Union build up their oil infrastructure. he was one of the key players.
Yasha, was this before, during, or after World War II?
This is right before. So this is before. This is the 30s. Yeah.
I see. Okay.
So I mean, you know. So, like, you know, I have a quote from Stalin here. You know, we are the world's greatest market, and we are prepared to order a large amount of goods and pay for them. Stalin told us
that sounds like a hell of a communist statement there.
Exactly.
<Go ahead.
laughs> Exactly. And so, Koch signed $5 million. It was worth a contract to build their refineries in the Soviet Union. Yeah. In 1929. He hosted a delegation of Soviet oil planners in 1929 in Wichita.
I'll check on that. I will. I know some old people in Wichita. They'll dig around for me on that.
Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, you know, that's the thing. There's got to be a lot of interesting documents, you know, somewhere. And there have to be, you know, from the local papers.
I'll bet the local papers were pushing it, and I'll bet there's pictures
exactly.
and all that.
Yeah. I mean, that'd be great. If you can get a picture of Freddie, you know, standing with a couple of Soviet bureaucrats, that'd be just brilliant.
Well, you can count on that, dude. I'm digging, because I'll tell you, I'll be real short, dude. Then I want to turn it back to you, but I've been digging around, and I ran into a old 74-year-old. She at that time, and this was in the 1950s, I believe. In the 1950s, well, no, it might have been the early 60s. She's 74 now, and she at that time was a gay divorcee. She just came back. She married. She's a Kansas girl. She married a guy who was in the CIA or.
Whoa.
She didn't know what he was in, but hung around the embassy, military attaché officer for various embassies in Europe, okay?
Uh-huh.
And she married him, and he transported her over there, and she ended up getting divorced from him and came back to Kansas. And first thing, she's a bit of a, what do you call it, diva, you know? She was good looking and divorced, you know, and she knew all the points of entry. And she was, you know, farming around, you know, shopping around. And she ended up swimming in a bathing suit. Well, I'm not even sure she was wearing a bathing suit the way she told the story. Here's what she told me, and this was over Thanksgiving. She went to this little, it was a magnificent piece of property just outside of Wichita.
Mm-hmm.
And she said it went down this long road. She was dating a guy who was Armenian, and he was a rich Armenian. He sold antiques, and his family, she might be exaggerating, but she said the family owned most of the silver that got out of Bolshevik Russia. A lot of the silver stuff from the Tsar and stuff, and they sit on it and they use that to generate seed, use that as seed money to build their little family empire.
So they're essentially like an Armenian aristocrat, right?
Yeah,
like, sort of that escape.
Right, and his family, they did that, and he was sort of a first generation American, and he and her were he was friends with her. That's what she called, quote, we were friends. But he was older than her at that time, and he took her out to this remote farm one day and said, "Well, you can go swimming out there. They have a swimming pool," and it was David. And so they went out there and they went to. And she said, "Oh, it was a very beautiful property. It was really
David
very humble."
Wow.
It was David, and it was a. She said he had a cottage. And it was a. It wasn't very. It wasn't a mansion. It was a cottage, and they had. She described the swimming pool, the trellis that went out the entrance to it, and how it was a. It was a conservative pool. It wasn't like shaped like a kidney bean or anything. It was just a straight pool. It was a long pool. It was clean. And so she. I don't know if she was swimming nude or with the bathing suit. But
well,
she
how
never
many people in Wichita? How many people in Wichita
she,
have?
Let me just. I'll be real quick. She said.
Okay.
She said I went and swam laps all afternoon while David and this guy, this rich Armenian, set up in the veranda on the long chairs and watched me swim all day. That was before David. And she said that's before David went to New York City.
Yeah. Well, that's an, you know, this is interesting.
Yeah.
This is interesting on a kind of a, even a deeper level because, I mean, well, okay. So what the fuck we have here the Kochs, which are did business in the Soviet Union, right? Now hanging out with an Armenian guy in Wichita. Who
right,
obviously,
exactly.
You know, an Armenian guy, Armenia is, you know, for people who don't know, Armenia is a country that's kind of, in, you know, well, it was part of the kind of the Russian Empire and part of the Soviet Union. Now it's an independent country, but it was part of the Soviet Union. It's right under, so it's kind of in the southern Russia in the Caucasus. It's right above Iran. But it's everyone there speaks Russian. It was part of the Soviet Empire, part of the Soviet Union. I mean, part of the Russian Empire, part of the Soviet Union. So it's part of Russia, you know, in a lot of ways, and it's a close ally of Russia. So it's and that's I mean, that's already two Russian connections. Why the hell, you know, that sounds a little bit kind of weird. I mean, if you think about it.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I got the guy, the Armenian's name, man. And
we're gonna have to talk about
and
it.
And he's very well known in Wichita too. Very well known. He may not be alive, but yeah, I'll send you his name. I'm keeping it off air because
yeah.
I'm gonna real quick before Dr. Scaminacci, he's gonna come on. I want you to stay on with because you're gonna hear some stuff. You guys can compare notes. But I want you to—I want to see if our man in Washington—he's still online. I want to—he has a source too. But I've been tracking it down about—I think it's Charles Koch who still lives down there in Wichita. David is banging has been banging. David's been banging ballerinas up in New York City for years and years. But I think Charles.
No, he said he can't get it up anymore. He can't get it up anymore. He said.
Okay. Hey, our man in Washington, are you still on air? Let's see if we can get
back on.
Hey, could you give us that tip? I ran it by Yasha, and tell us your tale of woe without naming any names, but you can, just delicately walk around to give Yasha a little bit more of a local angle on the Koch brothers, at least on what you know from, I guess, one of the offspring of the Koch brothers. Could you, without naming any names, just talk about what you know, that girl you happened to have been poking a while back. Go ahead.
Well,
we do our work.
Yeah,
well, I don't know if you poked her or not, but you got Dr. Scaminacci's online now. But I want you to let me open the phone up and ask him to wait a minute, and I want you to tell your story. Let's see if this. I think this is Dr. Scaminacci.
Yeah, I'm here.
Dr. Scaminacci, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, hold on, brother. We'll get you on. We'll all get on this together, and we'll let you lead the show on a deep history on the Libertarians and the Tea Party in just a minute. Will you hang on, Doctor?
Yeah, sure.
All
just
right,
call me.
Okay, we're calling James, by the way, Yasha, when he gets on. All right, now our man in Washington, proceed with your tale of woe about the old girl you were poking.
Well, I was living in Lawrence, Kansas at the time. And,
Douglas County,
you know, probably the only Democratic county in the state of Kansas. And seeing this the lady, very attractive lady, and her and I sort of started seeing each other. And she was telling me about her boyfriend, or ex-boyfriend, that was I believe it was Jefferson County jail. And for drug-related charges.
Oh.
So she was telling me about they went down to Wichita one time, her and her ex-boyfriend, and they went out in the middle of the country, this real long road out in the middle of nowhere, and it opened up to this extravagant estate, huge house, you know, in-ground swimming pool, Olympic-sized in-ground swimming pool. And I go, wow, in Wichita? And she said, well, yeah. And she goes, well, you've heard of the Koch brothers. Of course. Back then, I was pretty ignorant about that subject. And I go, no.
Back then, you didn't we're just poking around.
I was just poking it. Yeah, I didn't care. You know. Or they own a bunch of, they own, like, the majority of the oil refineries in the state of Kansas. And the way she described this house was like, holy crap. You know, you walk in, it's got the winding staircase that goes up to the upper level, both sides from the foyer. It's just this huge house. And I said, well, how come, so how's this guy related to them? And she said that he was the son of one of the Koch brothers.
Wow.
And he was in jail for, he was in the state penal system for cocaine addiction, cocaine possession with intent to sell, and multiple DUIs. Matter of fact, he had so many DUIs, his license was suspended indefinitely.
When was this? What, around what time?
This was back in 2005, 2006.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Everything
was kept pretty hush hush. I wasn't, I was supposed to be sworn to secrecy and all this. And, needless to say, when he got out of county jail, she ran back to his arms because that's where the money was.
Obviously.
She dumped you. Now, there's two more proletarian notes on this that I got to add. One, she's an artist, and he found her in the trailer park where he was living.
Yeah.
The girl was an artist, a really talented painter. She probably still is. But Mark poked her in the trailer park, and he just poked around and found this. He didn't really know about it. Then I went and checked the Jefferson County Jail. I know a couple of detectives there, and they did a record search. Now, when I asked for the record search, I didn't fill out a formal form, which I'm going to have to do. Well, it was pure hearsay. Hey, check and see if there was ever a Coke in first name Dennis, isn't that correct?
Yes.
Man from what? Yeah. I said, and the detectives did search and emailed me back and says, nope, never been here. But when I asked him about that, he goes, oh, that sounds familiar. And this was mouth to mouth, you know, I was talking to him. and he said, well, you know, they hired me. This is how the power of the Cokes go. When they were having that, when them brothers were fighting in court, William was fighting, listeners, William Koch was fighting with Charles and David Koch in a lawsuit, intra-family lawsuit. This Jefferson County detective, who will shall remain nameless, told me, he says, they hired 50, 60 cops all from around the Topeka area, and they just rented the whole Ramada Inn, and our job was to guard them, to go, do security work for the Ramada Inn for, you know, several floors of the Ramada Inn. I said, well, you're a cop now. He says, well, I was a cop then. I said, so he hired duty on duty cops. I said, oh yeah. He wouldn't tell me who it was, which of the Koch brothers it was, or which side he was on. But he said, yeah, it was a big deal in Topeka. They just like took over Topeka around the district court during that trial.
Oh, because they were living in the hotel, and so they wanted to be guarded because they were like they had to live among the people, right?
And they hired 50 to 60.
So they need 50 cops to surround them when they leave their fucking compound. That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing? And that's the same cop who just told me, never been a Dennis Koch in the Jefferson County jail. Now, you get the feeling that maybe he's sort of bullshitting me, you know what I mean? So what I'm going to do is file a formal written request. So, and I'll bet you our man in Washington might have his wires crossed a little bit. You sure it wasn't in Douglas County? No possibility, Douglas County, eh?
No, it was there right there in the Oskaloosa.
I can use my sort of channels to look for this. But look, why would the Kochs allow their son to be put in jail? I bet it was some weird lesson that they're teaching him or something.
That's what she said.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's what she said.
Exactly. So
Because you have to remember that they bought that mobile home that she was living in. She did tell me that.
There's the paper.
Oh, they bought the mobile home?
Yeah, they bought that mobile home for her and him
really nice of them. God.
Well, they basically didn't want him to come back to Woodstock. This is, I'm thinking back. These are the stories she was telling me that basically ostracized him from the family, except from being an embarrassment and. And another point I want to make is that when this woman that Mike was talking about, this 74-year-old woman talking about this...
Easy now. Go ahead.
Going down this long road, it's sort of the coalition. It's probably the same place that this girl went to.
Yeah.
Because she's described as almost identically to what this older lady described of going back in the 30s. Because she said it was a long road...
No, man, it was the 50s or 60s. I'll get it.
Well,
50s
or 60s, but anyway, it's basically the coalition is the same thing that this older lady described to you, Mike, and what the girl that described to me was basically you took this long road and all of a sudden you opened up into this beautiful estate out in the middle of nowhere. And she did it. Punctuated that they had this beautiful Olympic-sized in-ground pool.
Yeah.
And I'm going, it's got to be the same place.
Sounds like they
improved
the facilities, though. Yeah.
I think the old woman was skinny-dipping to show off her wares to the exiled Armenian.
This was the
60s,
too, right? This was the 60s.
Huh?
So she was, this is all like
flower
power and all that,
Yeah, it was the middle 60s and swimming in and she was very emphatic. She said it was David Koch's place before he went to New York. So, well, we got another guy coming on, a man from Washington. I'm going to put you on mute so we can listen to Dr. James Kamanashi the third, and I'm going to bring him on air, and we're going to go deep into libertarian politics and multi-million billionaires. And yes, there is a Koch link. Is there a conspiracy here, listeners in Kansas? Yes, I think there is. Doctors, welcome to the new profane radio free Kansas, Dr. James Scaminacci.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
All right. And Yasha is listening in. Yasha Levine. 11 of the Exiled Online is on air with us. So
yeah, I've been enjoying listening to Yasha. I haven't caught the whole thing, but really, really glad to be on with Yasha. Like his work very much.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. James.
Hey, just call me James. Just call me James. I don't like the doctor part.
But you got, you are a doctor of sociology, and you're working on a new book. Yeah, I mean, come on, man. I got a toothpick. That's why I got you on my show. Toot your horn, and that's my job, is to toot smart people like you, Robert Perry, Yasha Levine, Dave Lindorf, some of the great guests I have on Radio Free Kansas, and I want to put you guys on a more familiar scale, because I'll tell you right now, you're, I taped a thing, listeners, and you could have heard even as late as this last Wednesday mystery section. Last Wednesday, I played for the umpteenth time Dr. James Scaminacci, connecting the dots, talking about a strange thing called fourth generational warfare, and his upcoming book. And hey, James, I mean, man, this is something Yash has got to hear. Give us about a 5-10 minute synopsis, and I want to hear you mash it up with Yasha. And we still got our man on Washington, talking about the Koch brothers' offspring. But tell us what you give us about a 5-10 minute summation of. First off, I guess, what is fourth generational warfare, and how do they infiltrate the official government presses?
Official government what?
Presses, dude. The Marine Corps. I played that interview with you. I taped it. Man, that is dirt, dude.
Okay. Well,
I mean,
okay.
These people are everywhere. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Fourth generation warfare was an article written by William S. Lind, who at the time was the director of cultural conservatism at the Free Congress Foundation. Now, the Free Congress Foundation at the time, which was 1989, but even prior to that, was headed by the late Paul Weyrich. And Paul Weyrich was one of the three architects of the New Right that emerged in 1979, he along with Howard Phillips and Richard Viguerie. Now, Howard Phillips is known for being the head of the U.S. Constitution Party. He is a Christian Reconstructionist. And that means that he is a strong follower of Russus Rushtuni. Now, Reconstructionism basically is a minor, so very small, but very strong influence in the Christian right or the Christian nationalist movement, which basically holds that rather than retreating from politics, the evangelicals should be engaged in politics, and that they should have dominion over the political system, the economic system, and they should run the country. So they need to reconstruct America as a Christian nation. It's been a Christian nation, it was a Christian nation, it should be a Christian nation. And the U.S. Constitution and all laws should follow the Ten Commandments and the Bible. And so this is basically called theonomy, is what the scholars call it. But basically it's a movement that white Christian males ought to run the government, ought to run the economy. And one of the people that are very, very influential in this Christian Reconstructionist movement is Gary North. Gary North is an accomplished libertarian economist. And he, of course, is linked directly to Ron Paul, to Lou Rockwell. And so what I tried to do on my articles on political Chile was show how Howard Phillips and Ron Paul and Gary North were all connected in terms of pursuing a strategy for the Tea Party movement, which was has its central goal is to delegitimize the federal government, and has as its central premise of this strategy is that the Federal Reserve System is going to eventually collapse in a serious collapse, and that will allow them to come to power. Now, just to connect the last dot, Gary North is a follower and a supporter of fourth-generation warfare. And back in 2004, 2005, he wrote an article on Osama bin Laden, and he referenced and said people ought to read fourth-generation warfare articles by William S. Lind. Now,
who?
S. Lind.
William
S. Lind, L-I-N-D.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Lind was writing a lot of anti-war articles at antiwar.com, which is a libertarian website run by Lou Rockwell, which is he and Ron Paul are in the Ludwig von Mises Institute. So they're all kind of connected. So let me just give you what the gist of fourth-generation warfare is.
Yeah.
Okay, and this is, and you can see how it immediately ties into the North Ron Paul strategy, and it'll tie into a lot of things that that Yasha's been writing about, and Mark Levine's been writing about, David Neuert, a whole bunch of people have been writing about this, but they don't realize that there's this warfare element to it. And so here basically it's very simple. In 1989, and the date's important, 1989 is 3 years before the Christian Patriot Militia movement is forming. Okay, that's the big meeting in Estes Park where Larry Pratt goes to talk to all these racist, anti-Semitic Christian identity guys and guys in the Ku Klux Klan and the neo-Nazis that eventually formed the Christian Patriot Militia. So 3 years before, Lind writes an article in the U.S. Marine Corps Gazette, and this is an official Department of Defense publication, and he talks about fourth-generation warfare being a state of war between a state actor, read the federal government, but it could be any state government, any state, and a non-state actor. In this case, it would be the Patriot Militia movement that was coming. It could be the anti-immigration movement. It could be the Tea Party movement. But he also wrote that it could be a religious movement, or it could be a racial movement. So in 1989, he writes this article on fourth-generation warfare, lays out a number of concepts that basically I interpret to be the operational art of how to set up a militia. And in 1994, he publishes a second article in the U.S. Marine Corps Gazette. Again, for your readers, for your listeners, this is an official Department of Defense publication. And in this U.S. Marine Corps Gazette article of 1994, President Clinton is President Clinton, but he doesn't name President Clinton. But he basically says that the Democratic Party and all liberals are part of this conspiracy to undermine the Judeo-Christian values of America. And the Judeo-Christian values of America is basically a code word for Christian nation. And he argues that these policies of the Democrats and are really the policies of what he calls cultural Marxists, which again comes back from his Free Congress Foundation hat, where he's the director of cultural conservatism. And cultural Marxism are really economic Marxists in the cultural realm, and their job is to undermine the United States completely and divide it ethnically and religiously and gender-wise and everything. And he ends up by arguing that the Marine Corps, for which this article was written, will end up basically as a white Marine Corps, black Marine Corps, and maybe even a gay Marine Corps. And he closes the article by saying that the next real war in America is going to be the next real war is coming to America is going to be fourth generation warfare. Now, which means that warfare is going to be in the United States, and it's going to be fourth generation warfare. It's going to be a non-state actor against the federal government, in which the central objective is to delegitimize the federal government. Well, the entire right wing has been over the last 25 years since the 1990s, but even earlier, but since at least since the 1990s and the Patriot Militia came into being, has been to delegitimize the entire federal government.
Well, I want to interject something, Dr. Sure. Dr. James. I mean, real quick. Now, listeners, you can hear that every day like a flood out here between Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity. We're just blindsided on AM radio. The farmers out here have it on their pickups. That's what you turn on. You get in their pickups, you turn on the radio, that's what it's on. This is nothing but, that's all they've been doing is delegitimizing the federal government and focusing attention around how many Christmas trees are in the White House under President Obama. Go ahead, Dr. James Scaminace.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that point, Mike, because it is every day, And what, you know, Media Matters does a great job in pointing it out, and other websites. David Neuert in his book, The Eliminationist, and his new book, I can't remember the name, it's on my shelf, but, you know, David Neuert's new book with John Amato. It's all about delegitimizing the federal government. It's all about destroying confidence in the federal government. It's about raising doubts about whether the values of the government match up with the values of American citizens. And Ron Paul wrote this strategy for Ron Paul, in which he laid out the strategy and said, look, we have to operate at the local level, and we have to contest everything at the local level. We have to contest the legitimacy of the federal government at the local level. We have to take over the Republican Party at the local level. And when this system crashes, we have to be in position to seize power. And that's what this is all about. And to get to what Yasha's writing about on the Koch brothers, they funded a separate part of the Tea Party movement. There's two Tea Party movements. One was planned by Ron Paul and Gary North with, you know, the help of other strategists, Howard Phillips, John McManus, Robert Schultz. You know, they have their section of the Tea Party movement. And the Koch brothers, or David Koch, through his Americans for Prosperity, has funded a large section of the Tea Party movement. And there are two Tea Party movements, and there's a lot of overlap between them. And what's going on is that at the local level, Ron Paul's Campaign for Liberty, the Oath Keepers, which is directly linked to Ron Paul, people who attended the Continental Congress that was put on by Rob Schultz and Howard Phillips' Constitution Party and Ron Paul's Campaign for Liberty are all operating at the local level to bring these Tea Party groups into this Christian nationalist, white nationalist fold. And it's a very interesting thing to observe at the local level.
Now I want to remind Yasha, you got a hot mic there, Yasha. So if you don't,
do?
Yeah. So,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, oh. Yeah. Your mic is wide open.
Let me ask something. You can
just co-host with me, but I want to do one thing, Yasha. Dr. James Scaminacci III. I got a couple questions, and real quick, you can just yes or no them, because I want Yasha. I'm very interested in hooking you and Yasha up. But mm-hmm. Dr. James, look, brother, honestly, people don't understand that, and I think that's a new development in both your work. I know you're shopping for publishers. I'm going to do my best to help you get it. But let's very shortly. I guess you can't yes or no this. But what did you do, interestingly enough? Could you tell us what you did in your past before you got your sociology PhD? What did you do over in Bosnia, Dr. James?
Well, actually, I got my PhD, and then I worked in Bosnia.
And so what did you do there, Dr. James?
Well, I was a civilian intelligence analyst. I was employed by the U.S. Department of the Army.
Uh-huh.
And I did a lot of different things, but when I was there in Bosnia for 4 years, we, under the Clinton administration, we had to implement.
James.
Sorry?
You hunted war criminals.
Yes, who were blocking the Dayton Agreement. Yes, they were unindicted war criminals. These were guys who were the murderers and rapists and people who blew up buildings, who were really low in the grass, who weren't going to be indicted by the Hague as being war criminals, but the Hague approved of us going after them and charging them with murder, rape, blowing up, terrorism, things like that. And so that's what we did.
So, Dr. James is eminently qualified for hunting, let's call them fourth-generational war criminals here in the United States.
They are.
And I think... Yeah, okay, Yasha, the mic is open, brother. It's a hot mic. I will never shut you down, Yasha. Shoot. go for it.
Well, I mean, you know, I just want to revisit this idea that there are, you know, multiple tea parties or two tea parties. You know, there are really more than two tea parties. There are dozens of them. You know, they're not really tea parties. They're different segments of the same kind of thing. It's like well, okay. You know, it goes back to this idea of virtual politics, right? So even within the sort of libertarian movement, right, there are different libertarian kind of sects or parties, right? So you have like the Ron Paul people, you have the Tea Party people that are pretty new. Then places like Reason Magazine, right, which cater to a more intellectual audience, and you know, then there are like the other segments which are, you know, catered to more nationalistic elements, right? Catered to more civil libertarian elements, right? So this machine, this libertarian machine, right? Yeah, the Tea Party is the Tea Party that came about after Obama was elected. You know, yes, it's kind of a new thing, but there these different fronts of the libertarian, right, party, you know, they exist in a multitude of forms. You know, they cater to all sorts of they come in all sorts of flavors and sizes and cater to different, you know, consumers, to different types of people in America, right? So in order to kind of get everyone to, you know, jump on board on libertarian bandwagon, right? So it's but you know what's also interesting about this is that, you know, yes, there's this fourth generational warfare, which is sounds to me a lot like just a revolution, right? Is that what it is, James? I mean,
well,
because
comments.
It seems like if you, yeah.
Two comments on the fourth generation warfare. It's very similar to a revolution, but it's a deliberate strategy of undermining a government, of provoking a crisis of legitimacy, and coming to power. When in William Lynn's writings on this, he always talks about that using military force using violence is actually a very small part of it, and. So it's not necessarily open revolution. It's just that what he argues is that, and you can apply this to the Patriot Militia, you could apply it to the armed neo-Nazi groups and Ku Klux Klan, is that the federal government no longer has a monopoly on the use of force. And if they use force against Patriot Militias, there will be retaliation. Okay, that's very clear. Timothy McVeigh made that.
Also, it seems like you actually want them to. It just sounds like to me. Well, look, a revolution. You know, or like, there's different stages of or different types of ways to topple a government or to right to and obviously, you know, open warfare against a state, but with. Is not always. I mean, well, sometimes you want to provoke it, right? Like in the sense, I don't know, in the case of like Waco or
they see that as a provocation.
Because you see that as provocation, but you see that it only boosts, you know, your the cause, right? You draw the federal government out and you show that yes, look at this federal government. It is a totalitarian government.
But they have a strategy for this. Okay, mm-hmm. The thing is, they have a strategy for this, and they have their own intelligence estimates of this, and their strategy is based upon what Gary North called the central premise, that this system will collapse. Okay.
Well, let me ask you a question. Where do they go once a Republican is in office? See, because it seems like every time this thing is activated or this kind of these plans come to the forefront, only when a Democrat is in office. And when Bush was in power, there's no revolution.
Actually, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that was not true. When Bush was in power, people forget. Well, they tend to not to see the significance of it. But when Bush was in power from about 2004 to 2007, the end of 2007, because in 2008 then starts, you know, the presidential primary system, and things, you know, get blurred after that. But between 2004 and 2007, there was a very strong anti-immigration movement in the United States. Okay? And this anti-immigration movement was driven by the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps. And the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps was headed by Alan Keyes. Now, Alan Keyes was not a member of the Free Congress Foundation, but he was very, very close to the Free Congress Foundation. And the Minuteman chapters around the country were staffed by guys from John Tanton's white nationalist movement, anti-immigration groups, organizations that he had, which was the Federation for American Immigration Reform. And while that was happening, and they were targeting Bank of America, and they were targeting Mexican consulates, they were targeting Hispanic workers at day labor centers and things like that, and trying to get them out of various cities and deny them driver's licenses, et cetera, et cetera. This was all John Tanton's war of attrition. And his groups wrote about that, and the Southern Poverty Law Center covered it extensively. But at the same time, William Lind was writing at the Free Congress Foundation, delegitimizing the federal government, delegitimizing the Republican and Democratic parties on immigration, and calling for building a border wall and supporting the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps and things like that. What I'm trying to say is that what escaped the notice was the Christian right entered into this anti-immigration movement through the Secure Borders Coalition and then through the Families First and Immigration Coalition. And those groups are still active. And they're still active within the Tea Party movement. And so it's not true that under Bush nothing happened. It's just that people didn't recognize that one, or really take the grasp the significance of it, but one whole segment of the right wing, the paleoconservatives, the paleo-libertarians, and part of the Christian right, were delegitimizing Bush on the issue of immigration. And this just happened into 2008.
That's true. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, in the sense that, yes, these elements are active, and then, you know, they were really, they were pissed off at Bush for the, you know, on immigration. But here's the thing is that, you know, the it was nothing like what you saw, you know, during under Clinton, or you know, now under Obama, where, you know, it was kind of a, you know, it was immigration. It's an important issue, but it's more marginal, I would say. You know, it's not like this direct attack on the legitimacy of the federal government. And
it was
also
a direct attack.
It existed, right, kind of on the fringes. So it wasn't allowed to rise into the mainstream as much, right?
It's not true, Yasha. It's simply not true, because you have the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League writing article after article and major reports on the mainstreaming of hate that came from the fringe, that came into the mainstream through CNN, through Lou Dobbs, for example, as one of the prime examples. And you forget that in 2004, Arizona passed, I think, one of their Proposition 200 against immigrants. And right after that, the Minuteman started in April of 2005. And then you had this nationwide anti-immigration movement that was going to the border. And when these guys go to the border with weapons and say, well, you know, we're guarding the border because the federal government can't protect us, that's delegitimizing the federal government. And when they say, you know, we have to in Kansas or in Iowa, you know, we have to drive out Mexican immigrants, they're saying that the federal government can't protect us. That's delegitimizing it. And so what happened is people didn't realize it. Okay, that's all I'm saying is people just don't realize what was happening under the radar.
I agree with you. I mean, yes, these things were all happening, but I guess, you know, it's like these things have to keep these things warm, and you have to keep these groups functioning for when they are going to be, you know, when you're going to need to activate them for some sort of cause, right? And And the thing is only when a Democrat or, you know, not a Republican, right, comes into power are they really turned on to, you know, full throttle, right, all these things, all over the place.
Again, Leonard Zeskin in his book Blood Politics points out that some of the most violent attacks from the right wing occurred under President Reagan when there was the order and posse comitatus. You know, out there. You know, so it's not driven by Republicans and Democrats. What's driven by is that these guys want to take power, Yasha. They want to take power. And let me just give you a sort of capsule, because I started off one of my Political Chili articles with this to show how this movement is actually structured. And it goes back to what you said. I'm agreeing with you with what you said very much earlier, that there are different segments. And the different segments comes from Sarah Diamond's book back in 1995, The Road to Dominion. She said, well, you know, there's a new right, there's a Christian right, there's a racist right, and there's the neoconservatives. Four different segments. Chip Roulette picked up on this, and, you know, it has basically the same segments. And what I want to show you is that Ron Paul in September 2008, has his own counter convention. And who's at this counter convention? On stage with him, in plain sight, he's showing everybody in the United States, in the mainstream media, here is my movement. Since September 2008, it's only a few months from the emergence of the Tea Party movement, his Tea Party movement. And who's on stage with him? Wait a minute, Yash, let me just make, just make this point. Who's on stage with him? Howard Phillips, the leading Christian Reconstructionist political party in the United States. One of the major architects of the new right back in the 1970s. He's on stage. Howard Phillips would go on in the Constitution Party, would go on to put together the Continental Congress. There's John McManus, the president of the John Birch Society. The John Birch Society was there at the very beginning of the formation of the Council for National Policy. Chip Roulette says it is the number one propaganda outlet for the right wing. Everything that basically happens, basically all the sort of conspiracy theories are really influenced by that whole narrative that the John Birch Society developed back in the late 1950s, and they've been propounding ever since. He's on the stage with Ron Paul. Of course, Ron Paul has his own guy, Gary North, who's very close to him. Lou Rockwell is there. Lou Rockwell has the Ludwig von Mises Institute. That's the Austrian economics that you're interested in with, you know, being funded by all the libertarians. But the von Mises Institute is also part of the much larger neo-Confederate movement, all right, that exists in the entire South. Thomas Woods is there. Thomas Woods, Gross wrote his book. Thomas Woods was one of the founders of the League of the South. The only people who weren't there on stage that Ron Paul has never broken from, never denounced, was Don Black from Stormfront, David Duke. And what I tried to argue in the series of articles on Political Chili is that all the segments that you think of are segments aren't really segments. They're all networked together, and they all have a common strategy, and they all have a common strategic outlook. And that's I get down into the weeds. You got to look at strategy and persons and organizations, and then what they do in the real world. And when Ron Paul puts these guys, go ahead,
Dr. James. So that's why you call it this mysterious title, Fourth Generational Warfare. That it's sort of. They mix it up, and you really don't know who's who, but they...
And warfare now, if you actually read military journals, okay, which is, you know, not often that I do, but if you read military journals, you'll understand that the whole mode of warfare has changed. It is now network warfare. It's network warfare in the real world and network warfare in the virtual world.
Like WikiLeaks.
Like WikiLeaks is a form of fourth-generation warfare in the virtual world. You know, that's what governments have to deal with now. And if you look at parts of how the Tea Party movement developed, Gary North wrote how it would develop. And he said, he started off, he said, phase one is Ron Paul is going to gather all these names of people who contribute to his campaign. And we know he raised $34 million, of which $21 million we can't track, because not because of anything sinister, only because the law says if you give money to a political candidate and it's under $200, nobody has to really know.
Mm-hmm.
So where all that money, you know, 64% of the money that Ron Paul actually got, we really don't know where it came from. But Gary North said, listen, the first stage is I'm going to collect all these names of people who support Ron Paul. He goes, and then he goes, we're going to create a movement, and this movement's going to fly under the radar. And what they did was they made meetup groups, you know, meetup groups for Ron Paul. Meetup
mm-hmm.
groups for Ron Paul became Campaign for Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And Campaign for Liberty existed in the virtual world, okay,
mm-hmm.
on the Internet. And then all of a sudden, Campaign for Liberty was not just in the virtual world. It was in the real world. And they went out and they started contacting local Tea Party groups and going, hey, you know, we could do this, we could do that. And if you see that, you know, the Campaign for Liberty is always linked to the Constitution Party. Campaign for Liberty is always has a link to the John Birch Society. You can go anywhere at the real local level, and you'll see that the same movement that Ron Paul showed in 2008 at the convention is replicated at the local level. For example, this is an unpublished article, Oath Keepers was actually formed in January 2008. The idea, the conception of Oath Keepers that was headed by Stuart Rhodes was actually very early in 2008, and it had nothing to do with President Obama. It had everything to do with Hillary Clinton, because that was the presumptive Democratic nominee, and she was going to play the role of Hitler Nazi. She was going to be a feminazi wearing, she was going to be a dominatrix. She was going to put all the patriots in jail in the FEMA concentration camps, and that's where the whole Oath Keepers thing came in.
Okay.
Stuart Rhodes is the head of Oath Keepers. Stuart Rhodes played a direct role in forming the National Precinct Alliance in Las Vegas. The National Precinct Alliance is the organization around the country with, you know, chapters all over the country, all 50 states, to take over the Republican Party at the committee level, at the precinct level. And that's exactly the strategy laid out by Gary North. And so all I've tried to do is you put the strategy that they have written and part of the strategy which is unwritten with the personnel, the linkages, the personal relationships, the professional relationships, the ideological affinity between them, how they talk, how
mm-hmm.
they have the same outlook, and then you look at the organizations they form, and then you look
mm-hmm.
at what they do in the real world, and there are organizations that progressives don't even have any awareness are linked to
yeah.
Ron Paul directly. They don't even know they exist, they don't know what they do, and they don't know that Ron Paul has a direct influence on these groups. And so it all looks like it's random, it all looks like it's
exactly, yeah.
desegmented, and in fact, when you get down to it, they're very networked. Now, people will argue that I'm a conspiracy theorist, you know, I'm this
no,
and that.
No,
you know.
No, I won't do that. I'm going to
argue
with
you.
Go ahead, Yasha.
I am in complete agreement with you, 100% on this. But I want to make, and I want to just ask raise a point here. If these guys are planning and plotting the overthrow of the federal government, should we not prosecute them for treason?
No.
All of these guys, why not?
Well, you see, because they're not plotting the overthrow of the government. What they're saying is openly, and it's covered under the First Amendment, look, the Federal Reserve System is going to crash the economic system once again. And that's just, you know, that argument,
That's just one argument, right? That's just one of the – I mean,
well,
they're,
that's their
strategy. They are against statism, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so statism is just meaning that they are against a state. You know, the state that we are living in, as in the United States of America, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm just trying to make a – this is something that I've been thinking about myself, is that, look, these guys are openly saying they think that the the United States of America is not, well, it should be overthrown. The political order in this country is the federal government is an illegal entity or something of that nature, right?
Yeah, they are saying that.
There's a logical conclusion here. What's that?
But Yasha, all that's covered under the First Amendment. That's you know.
No, they can. Well, no. What's covered is the free speech. Well, they're actually actively plot. Well, yes, you can say whatever you want, but they're actually actively plotting, right? To do that.
Yes, but they're not plotting to blow up buildings or anything like that.
No, doctor.
Well, I mean, but they're plotting to.
Gentlemen, I want to interject one thing. When I was doing abortion clinic protection work as a paper licensed professional private detective, blah, 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 I went to the FBI several times about these crazies having these bomb-making booklets in their vans. I photographed the bomb-making booklets in their vans. I'd go outside the clinic perimeter and take pictures of them, and there would be bomb-making booklets in the van right there on the floor of the seat of the van. I take it to the FBI and say, God, look at these guys are hanging around here, you know, scaring the shit out of these women, and the FBI say, oh, that's the First Amendment, and that's all.
Let me ask you this then. You know how right now the FBI is essentially getting all these like Muslim teenagers, you know, who's you know smoking a little weed, and you know talking to them with saying, oh yeah, wouldn't it be great to blow up the Christmas tree, you know, and blow
and
up
shoot,
all these white people?
Let's do it. But these guys are talking about it,
and they're being tried in federal court, right? You know, all the time. These kids are being essentially set up by you know just by speaking about it, and sometimes, you know, they're actually given these bombs by the FBI. So what I'm saying is we have, like, a double standard here. Right?
It's not necessarily a double standard. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but in researching my book, I did have to consult, you know, lawyers. And I had the same view of you, Yasha. You know, God, isn't this sedition, you know, and seditious speech? And basically, my understanding of constitutional law in this area is that you can basically say anything you want against the federal government up until the time that your speech is going to result in an imminent action that would either kill somebody or destroy property. At that point, where the action is imminent, you know, it's like one thing to say, here's the difference. You can say, I think all nine Supreme – or listen, all four or five liberal judges on the U.S. Supreme Court ought to be hanged. That's covered under the First Amendment. Now let's suppose that I am outside the U.S. Supreme Court with 10,000 like-minded individuals, and I say, men, women, we ought to go into the Supreme Court, drag out those four or five justices, and hang them. At that point, you know, when we start walking towards the Supreme Court building – with the intent to hang these judges, we've crossed the line from speech to action.
Well, okay. Well, here's the thing, though. Okay, so why doesn't the FBI go in, infiltrate one of these militant groups, right, and say, hey guys, all right, I got this bomb making equipment, you know, let's go blow up the federal court building over there. Let's do it. And you know,
well,
I'm sure they could, you know, get a couple of guys. Just like they get a couple of these Muslim kids.
Well, they do
Muslim
do that.
Kids.
Yasha, they
well,
do that. I mean, the Hooterie militia that were arrested apparently were arrested because there was an FBI informant within the group. Now, the FBI can't – I think we would rightly say the FBI should not infiltrate every single group that's opposed to the federal government for whatever reason. Okay, because what ends up is a lot of left-wing groups that are for peace or for justice union rights get infiltrated. So the FBI has to be on a tethered to the Constitution and the law that you can infiltrate a group when they indicate that they actually really are intending to do something violent. I think I'm not a lawyer, but there ought to be limits on.
Well, look, I'm not advocating. All I'm saying is that these people are essentially, look, are anti-American. I mean, when you get down to the bottom of it, right, to the bottom of all the rhetoric, to the bottom of all the, you know, all their rhetoric about the Federal Reserve and all this shit, like, they are essentially, what they want is to overthrow the U.S. government, you know, and you know, this is something that people should kind of think about and understand.
They should.
That all this talk about libertarianism and all this talk about how, you know, it really is, at the basic level.
It is. Actually, you're 100% right.
It is sedition.
Well, it could be, you know, here's the thing about fourth generation warfare that Lynn wrote back in 1989. And he said, in 1989 he wrote, and I think in 1994 he repeated himself, but in 1989 he laid out, he said, listen, one of the things of fourth generation warfare is that the laws can be used against the state. You have First Protection Amendment. You can use that First Protection Amendment right up to the very tiptoe, the edge, the abyss of stepping over the line. You know what I'm saying?
And there's nothing the government can do. Exactly.
And then you
use the protection until the point you overthrow it, right?
Exactly. And, well, you don't have to overthrow it. It collapses.
Well, exactly.
There's a difference.
It's not
six of one, half a dozen of the other.
You dig under the foundation
and coming to power through its collapse are two different
okay,
things.
Okay, look, when you dig under the foundation, all right, of a building, you know, and you keep digging, you don't dig over the building. It collapses, right? But it doesn't collapse on its own. It collapses because of your actions.
Here's what they're saying, Yasha. Here's what they're saying is that we're going to contest the legitimacy, the moralness of the federal government in the moral plane. Okay, and that's covered by the First Amendment. We can contest the legitimacy of the federal government. We can argue that everything the federal government does is unconstitutional. We could argue that the 14th Amendment should be repealed, the 16th Amendment should be repealed, the 17th Amendment should be repealed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is all First Amendment in the moral plane. Then they turn around and say, listen, if you really understand this economic system, and here they have a lot of liberal economists that agree with them, this system is going to have another financial meltdown. It's going to have another economic collapse. And just today, your readers should go to read Simon Johnson either on Huffington Post or Baseline Scenario. And he's writing about J.P. Morgan, and he basically says J.P. Morgan's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, it's not only J.P. Morgan getting bigger, but Bank of America is getting bigger, Citigroup is getting bigger. But Simon Johnson says our choice – when J.P. Morgan collapses after becoming really, really big, is going to be either another great financial meltdown or an economic collapse he picks two countries, Ireland and Iceland. Well, you know, these guys are all connected. And if they have an economic collapse where they can't be saved, they're just too big to be saved. The federal government at that point is you have Obama or you have whatever Republicans in office, you know, just completely flabbergasted, don't know what to do. The American people are looking at, well, what should we do? The political elites don't know what to do, and confidence collapses. And at that point, when you no longer believe that the political and economic elites know what they're doing, you'll listen to anybody who comes along and says, I got this idea. Very simple.
No. Four minutes, gentlemen.
I agree with you, but here's the thing is that, you know, this all brings us back to, you know, the Kochs who are, you know, one of the biggest backers of all these various movements, right?
Yes.
And we don't really know how far their money is going or where it's going, but it's clearly going to fund a big portion of this movement. You know, and these guys, you know, they're you know, using essentially like Bolshevik kind of tactics, revolutionary tactics, and they are, I believe, you know, need to be looked at as enemy combatants. Because they're talking about, I'm just, You know, after 9/11, there was
Yasha,
all this
I agree with you.
Al-Qaeda operatives in
America. Yasha, I agree with you, and here's what I would say.
Right?
Here's what I would say.
Yes.
Is readers, and you should read, you know, books like, you know, Invisible Hands, The Family, you know, God's Prophets, you know, things
yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
You know, Kingdom Come by Michelle Goldberg, Randall Bomber's. Because these guys are radical revolutionaries.
Dr.
Yes.
James, you agree that they're traitors to what America was. I mean, they're traitors in a way, aren't they?
They have.
I mean,
look, there's two different visions of America right now. There's the vision that we all think it is, and there's the vision that America's a Christian nation and white Christian males ought to run everything. The federal government ought to be so small that big
that
business can do whatever.
That is against the Constitution.
Well,
that is against the Constitution.
And there's two different visions, two different moralities contesting right now. And right now, the right-wing one appears to be winning. And the problem is that progressives don't understand is that this is for the whole, all the ball, this is for everything. Okay,
yeah.
When these guys come to power, they're going to change everything. Okay, this is not let's just elect a Republican. This is let's change the system. You know, you go back, read the articles I wrote on Ron Paul. He would define life as beginning at conception. He would strip the U.S. Supreme Court from hearing any court.
Oh, they're all pro-life. They're all pro-life.
It's not only pro-life.
I know that.
Ron Paul would strip the U.S. Supreme Court and every federal court from hearing a First Amendment Establishment Clause case. He would strip it from hearing any privacy case dealing with reproductive rights, dealing with gay marriage.
Exactly.
This is a completely different vision of America.
Exactly. It goes against the document that founded this country, right?
Absolutely, Yasha.
Look,
we are 100% agreement.
This is something that needs to be repeated and understood by people. I mean, you know, they are against America. The America that was set up, that is based on the Constitution, this document that they supposedly, you know, hold in this high regard and talk about all the time about constitutional rights and all this. They actually want to destroy it, right?
They do.
They want to change it. They want to completely, you know, they want to cut it up and edit it. So they want to create a new government. They are against America. They are anti-American. They are enemy combatants against America that are living in America today. They have U.S. citizenship, yes, but they want to overthrow the U.S. government, right? They are essentially homebred terrorists. They have infiltrated America from the inside. I mean, I could be talking about communists here, right? I mean, I could be a John Bircher right now, right? I'm not.
I think the word is a totalitarian dictatorship, and they've forgotten the words of the general welfare of the citizens in the union.
Exactly.
The general welfare.
You know, Yasha, the thing that has to happen.
A more perfect union.
That's right.
It wasn't we the corporations of the United States formed this
government. But you know, sometimes you know, like we have to simplify. This dizzying array of all of these organizations and all of these groups. You know, it's so vast and so complicated that it's very important to understand how it works. But it's also important to understand the larger issue here, which I think. You know, there's certain things that need to be repeated, simple things that need to be repeated over and over and over again for people to kind of really – for people who don't spend hours and hours and hours like you and I obsessively looking into this web, this very, very frightening web of billionaires funding all of these really extremist people who really just want to do death penalty for homosexuals and all sorts of things. I mean, you know, like – what is the final, what do they want?
They want a white Christian nationalist nation. And what I'm trying to do in my book, I'll recommend that you interview Julie Ingersoll from Religion Dispatches or, you know, Rachel Tabachnik from Talk to Action, is what's being missed is that underneath libertarianism, or overlaid on libertarianism, overlaid on this neoconservatism, is that there's a theological dimension. They want a white Christian nationalist nation, and that's driving everything, and it links them to big business, and people have missed this revolutionary radical dimension to the Tea Party movement, but it's present in Ron Paul, and you know
they,
there are plenty
they
of books
want the Confederacy. They want the Confederacy.
We've got to stop the show, folks. At Yasha, Yasha, Doctor. No, was it a good show? Did you feel intellectually stimulated, brother? I got 10 seconds. Yes,
I did.
Yasha, Doctor James Scaramucci. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Free Kansas. Kansans, we need to think about this. Thank you. Good afternoon.